A leak of U.S. government documents sheds new light on the state of the war in Ukraine, Washington's involvement, Ukraine's dwindling supplies, and how Russia has gotten weaker.
That doesn't mean that Russia is becoming less dangerous. No, the weaker Russia is more aggressive Russia.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, culture and food along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I think it's such a beautiful thing when through a bite of something, your world opens.
And Muslims everywhere are observing Ramadan. In parts of southern Turkey devastated by recent earthquakes, the holy month is a challenge. This man says, we can't go home, we can't prepare food together, and we have to take what the state gives us. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us. There are still lots of unknowns about a leaked trove of classified U.S. intelligence information. Secrets about Russia's war in Ukraine made their way online and then eventually into the news. As we reported earlier this week, the documents were first posted by the leaker on the social media platform Discord a few months ago. Over the past few hours, we've gotten a much fuller picture of the key suspect. This afternoon, the FBI arrested a 21-year-old member of the Massachusetts Air National Guard, Jack Teixeira. The incident has been embarrassing for the Pentagon and the White House. In Russia, officials at the Kremlin and media commentators are all paying close attention. The World's Daniel Offman has that part of the story.
As the Biden administration launched a, quote, full-blown investigation into this intelligence leak, the state-run news media in Russia took the story and ran with it. The leaked documents that had started showing up on Russian Telegram channels were discussed at length on Russian state TV. But Francis Scar noticed something here. He's with BBC Monitoring and spends hours a day analyzing Russian state media.
I think the reaction was quite interesting, actually, in the Russian state media. I think it kind of caught them unawares. Often you see some kind of major development internationally and the Russian state media comes out in unison. You see across the three main channels, they almost use the same phrasing sometimes in the way they react to it.
But Scar says that was not the case earlier this week when the story first appeared on Russian state TV.
Purely because these shows on Russian state TV last for hours every single day, it's impossible to control everything that's said on them. There have been a couple of cases where pundits on these shows have mentioned elements of the leak which point to Russian weaknesses and show that Russia has been deeply infiltrated by U.S. intelligence.
Scar offers this example. It played during a segment on a popular Russian political talk show called 60 Minutes.
This former intelligence official mentioning this fact that the U.S. seemed to have gained information by spying. It wasn't just open source information. And suddenly the presenter was caught unawares by this and asked him to elaborate. And as soon as he started explaining what it meant, she just quickly changed the subject.
So at times, when the information from the documents didn't fit the Kremlin's narrative, Scar says commentators scrambled to suppress it. They also sought to question the validity of the documents and play up instances that made the U.S. look bad. The highest-ranking Russian official to comment on the leaked documents is Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov. Peskov called the leaks, quote, interesting, but separately he questioned the authenticity of the documents. He said that everyone knows that the U.S. collects intelligence on everyone, and he claimed that Russia was already aware of a lot of the information that's come out. Pavel Luzin is a visiting scholar at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
For me, the collecting of information, of this information, was not a surprise. Because we know for many years that the United States invests in these capabilities a lot of money.
Luzin is also skeptical about some of the information that appears in these leaked documents. Nonetheless, he says that this information won't affect Ukraine's military planning.
Even if we take this leak seriously, we cannot see many of aspects. We cannot see the number of missiles, the number of artillery shells. We cannot see the actual number of armored vehicles. what we can see in these leaks, we can find in open sources by ourselves.
Luzin says that overall, we know a lot more about Russia's military capability than we do about Ukraine's.
The trend is that Russia is becoming weaker and weaker any single day. That doesn't mean that Russia is becoming less dangerous. No, the weaker Russia is more aggressive Russia.
Whatever comes out of the intelligence leak in the days ahead, Luzin says that one thing has not changed. Ukraine still has to win this war on the battlefield. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
The Colorado River is a vital source of water for agriculture and about 40 million people in the western U.S. and two Mexican states. Drought, climate change, and increased demand have put unprecedented strain on the river. U.S. federal, state, and tribal governments are haggling over how to ration water supplies. But there's another key player in this drama, Mexico. For more on that perspective, we reached out to Mario Lopez Perez. He consults on water issues at the World Bank and previously worked for Mexico's National Water Commission and joins me from outside of Mexico City. Mario, water from the Colorado River flows along the California-Arizona border into Mexico. How is it used once it gets there?
For the agriculture, it is vital. For the water supply, not so much because the amount of water they use is less compared to agriculture.
Mexico is entitled, I understand, by treaty to about 10% of the water flows, but in recent years it's had to accept less and less. How would the current plan for water reductions in the U.S. laid out by the Biden administration impact flows of water to Mexico?
It would impact in the same percentage as would impact to the U.S. According to the 1944 treaty, the percentage of reduction on the U.S. side will be applied on the Mexican side as well. The big difference is the proportion of the distribution among the U.S. states. The recent reduction of 70% that was applied to Mexico has affected the farmers. And let me tell you that the issue of the shortages that are taking place and will increase in time are not new. We saw that coming since 2010 or even a couple of years before that. So unfortunately, what we did was not prepare ourselves. We had a plan, but the plan has not been completed or implemented yet.
What was Mexico's plan and why wasn't it implemented?
First, we need to understand what's happening. This long and persistent drought, it is not an extraordinary phenomenon. At that time, 2010 or even before, we knew that this would be the new normal. Less snow, less rain, less runoff. The trend will not change, even with intermediate good years or wet years. So understanding that, we devised a plan with the U.S. That binational plan established some projects, developed, funded by both countries. These projects were basically to reduce the demand, but also to increase the water available. We devised the development of several desalination plants on the Mexican side and in the U.S. side. Also, the increase in efficiency in agriculture on the Mexican side and also on the U.S. side. There was a possibility to have exchange of water among both countries in terms of if we have improved the efficiency, we can lend you that. And in return, we will have some water stored at Lake Mead. So we had a plan. Since 2010, we knew what to do, but we haven't done it. That was 13 years ago.
So what's holding up action on adjusting to reduced water flows from the Colorado River in Mexico? Is it the national government, state governments?
Unfortunately, the plan was very slowly implemented because of funding, and the Mexican following federal regimes did in turn not support them, and it slowed down. Bureaucracy always tend to delay the toughest decisions. And the decision is to adapt to the new climate scenario that we are looking at. And this means changing behavior. We try to maintain the status of water, and this is not possible.
Do you see this reduced flows from the Colorado River as an existential threat to Mexico or just something that needs to be properly managed?
I think it just needs to be properly managed. It is not an existential issue. The agricultural area in Mexico mainly is to produce cash crops. The same cash crops that are produced in Yuma or in California, Imperial Valley. So they need to move from that. Say, for example, all the agriculture in Mexico were in greenhouses or tunnels, in vertical agriculture, you might say. Mexico will have any trouble at all, even with a huge reduction on the U.S. deliveries from the Colorado. El Paso, Texas does it. This is not new. It is a matter of making the people aware that this will be the new normal. It is a matter of political will.
Mario Lopez Perez is a consultant on water issues at the World Bank. He also previously worked for Mexico's National Water Commission. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Here's another problem that can occur when there's not enough water. Conflict. A new study spells the connections out explicitly between droughts in Central America over 20 years, starting in the 1990s, and violence in nearby cities triggered by food insecurity. Researcher Paolo Dodorico worked on the study. He's at the University of California, Berkeley. Paolo, your study took place on the Pacific coast of Central America, including southern Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. That region is called the Dry Corridor, the name kind of says it all there, but can you describe what that region is like?
This region is in Central America. The climate there tends to have a dry season that is during the summertime. And some years are drier than others because the ocean temperature control the seasonality and also the occurrence of droughts in this region.
Your study tracked the years from 1996 to 2016. How many droughts did you see in that time, and how did those droughts affect local food security?
Depends on how you count them, but between 4 to 6 droughts. And the impact was that because of agriculture, there is mostly rain-fed, so there is not much irrigation. During a drought, there is a drop in production, both of food crops, staple crops, and also the so-called cash crops that are good for income. And so they also affect food security because they give a purchasing power to the population.
How much of a drop in food production?
Between 20 to 50, 60%, depending on the year and the location.
So quite significant. What types of conflict did you then see in these case studies?
We are looking at urban conflicts. It can range from forms of social unrest, armed robberies, homicides. We included also other forms of social unrest, active protests, and forms of social discontent.
And so how strong was that link between food shortages or lowered food production and conflict?
Was highly significant. There is a significant association between drops in food production and the emergence of conflicts in these cities.
This feels like yet another negative impact that is linked to climate change, which is triggering already global food shortages. Are you expecting to see more conflict emerge locally in places with food shortages?
Yeah, in a way we are, because even the climate change predictions tend to suggest an increase in variability of precipitation in this region, and which means that there could be more exposure of the region to droughts. And as a result of that, there would be more conflicts.
Your paper also spells out, you know, potential solutions, and it seems like maybe there is kind of an obvious one, which is, you know, help local folks stockpile food, provide some sort of cash assistance or food assistance so that a drought does not equal food insecurity. Is that something that you see as a possible solution to this problem?
Yeah, typically the way to deal with a food crisis or prevent food crisis is either to rely on reserves or to import food from other regions. And importing food requires access to funds to make it happen. And trade, even our paper shows that food trade plays an important role in offsetting some of these local deficiency in food availability.
It strikes me that so many solutions to climate change are kind of basic development policies, you know, lifting people out of poverty, reducing food insecurity, stuff like that.
Yes, yes. Since here the driver is water, maybe in the longer run, there could be the need for investments in irrigation infrastructure that gives more resilience to the agricultural sector.
Paolo Dodorico is an environmental scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. He joined us from Rome. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Caroline, and thank you for having me here.
You're listening to The World. I'm Caroline Beeler. This is The World. The U.S.-Mexico border is the busiest in the world. Every year, hundreds of millions of people cross back and forth. All that mingling of people and ideas makes for a rich culture and cuisine. It's a terrain that celebrity chef Patty Heenich explores in her PBS series La Frontera. Season 2 premieres this month. Marco Werman spoke with Patty Heenich about what's in store.
Such a pleasure to meet you.
Such a pleasure to talk to you, Marco. I love hearing your voice.
First of all, what are fronterizos? Why do they fascinate you?
Okay, a fronterizo is a person who straddles between worlds, a person who lives in a dimension where cultures, cuisines, languages collide and mingle. And when we think about borders, we think about limits. Of course, in the last few years, we think about trouble. But in Spanish, the word frontera and fronterizo speaks more to possibilities and what's next and what's possible. And I think that the border and the borderlands are, you know, a third dimension full of possibilities.
Do you consider yourself a fronterizo? Did you before starting the series?
Well, you know, I couldn't put a word to it, but I come from a long line of immigrants into Mexico. So on my father's side, it was Polish farmers fleeing pogroms at the turn of the 20th century. On my mother's side, it was my grandmother from Austria and my grandfather from the Czech Republic fleeing the Holocaust. And they made Mexico their home. I was, of course, born a full-blooded Mexican, raised and proud in Mexico City, but I'm also Jewish. Then I moved to the U.S., to Texas, and people just couldn't put two and two together, Marco. It's like I was too Mexican, sounded too Mexican, culture too Mexican. But wait, what's that Jewish last name? Like people just couldn't put it together. And then I've been doing Patty's Mexican Table for over a decade, trying to share Mexico with the world. And then when I got to the border, you know, no one to judge the name, the last name, the accent. You can be so many things at the same time. And at the border, I feel really at home.
I mean, it's really refreshing to hear your take on the border because so many discussions of the border these days is so politicized. Is one of your goals with La Frontera to turn down the temperature on all things border or recast it in a different light?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, food is the best vehicle because...
Well, I was going to say food is, of course, front and center in this season. You take us to Mennonite cheese making in Mexico, but I was really awestruck when you dove into Mexico's watermelon industry. You meet Christian, a Mexican watermelon marketer. Let's hear a moment of that.
He's trying to convince me that watermelon can replace tomatoes.
Okay, so this is your watermelon
Watermelon pico de gallo.
Next up, a poke replacing tuna with watermelon, topped with watermelon rind instead of cucumber.
Okay, watermelon pico de gallo and poke. I get that, but then he goes on to make watermelon sushi. Were you sold?
So, in the beginning, I was very skeptical, and I knew I was getting the hard sell, you know? This is an adorable guy who lives and breathes watermelon. You walk into that watermelon office, and it's like a Disneyland of watermelons. But it was actually delicious. It was beautiful. And this is a product that the U.S. loves having 12 months out of the year, but the U.S. can only produce 3 or 4 months of the year. And then the watermelons go to the border, get in trucks, of course, super inspected by the USDA. And then you saw, I don't know if you saw how we tested for sweetness and sugar.
It's going to be remarkable for many Americans to see where their food comes from and the rigor that's taken to test for sweetness of a watermelon.
And I think the rigor is putting it lightly. If it's not sweet enough, it's not crossing the border. Whatever you may hear, you know, about the border, there's these everyday hardworking people making sure that you have watermelon year round. And the same goes for tomatoes and jalapenos and avocados.
That's just one snapshot you take of the border. You also get to out of the way places where the border is not such a looming obstacle. I'm thinking about the story you tell from Columbus, New Mexico, the only town in the U.S. where school buses pick up kids from Mexico at the border and bring them into the U.S. for class every day. Young kids who are U.S. citizens, and it's kind of surreal to see these little kids with their backpacks and passports going through the border turnstiles, waving goodbye to their parents. I mean, it seems like it's win-win. It seems like an ideal world, but not everyone crosses the border so easily, do they?
Absolutely, and this is the thing. Borders have changed, and borders can be subjective in a way. Also, in that third episode, I meet with Ronald Ryle, who is an architect who's building adobe ovens all over the border to make bread for people who are getting to the border because of different circumstances. And here I'm connecting with my grandparents who had to flee violence as well, right? It's very complicated for people in the borderlands because they have to deal with, as my friend Alfredo Corchado said, a journalist from the borderlands.
Sure.
Politicians and the news treat the border as a political piñata. So all these rules and enforcements and the way things are viewed and enforced change with time, with the political winds and the people there have to figure out how they're going to get to school or to work.
Well, speaking of politics, Patti, before season one of La Frontera, you said you were trying to reach supporters of President Trump. Why was that important? And do you think you did that?
At the height of the Trump re-election, I was looking at my Twitter feed and realizing that many people that were saying, you know, Patti's Mexican Table is my favorite cooking show had Trump 2020 on their bio. And I would say that our audience crosses the political spectrum, crosses into Hispanic. And I think, Marco, that is just the power of food. People who may say we don't want more Mexicans in this country are delighted eating tacos, you know?
You spoke earlier about your own family story. You used to work in a think tank thinking about policy. How did you pivot to cooking for a living and telling stories about food?
Marco, I just grew frustrated because I felt like we kept talking about the same things. We kept writing the same papers about trying to build bridges and understanding. And I was really hungry to help people connect with something that was tangible. And there's nothing more tangible than what you put in your mouth. And you can understand somebody else when you're tasting where they come from and what they are and who they are. And this happened to me when we went to Hatch, New Mexico for La Frontera. You know, I get there, a Mexican who lives and breathes chiles every day.
Right.
And I get to a town that calls itself the Chile capital of the world. I'm like, come on. I mean, are you kidding me? And then I was floored, Marco, by the diversity, the richness, the wealth of their chiles. And I just think it is incredible, the power of food. And of course, we have to have labels. We have to have categories to move through a chaotic world. But I think it's such a beautiful thing when through a bite of something, your world opens.
Yeah, it comes out really clearly in La Frontera, that approach. I got to say, it seemed you were not kidding when that Hatch chili landed on your tongue and the heat did not go away.
I know, exactly.
That was Marco Werman speaking with Patti Hienich about what's in store on her PBS series La Frontera. You are listening to The World. Cash used to be king, less so now. That's bad news for companies that print those bills. But there could be an upside if you want to fight crime.
A lot of it's used for tax evasion, illegal activity.
Some say it's time to rethink how much we need cold, hard cash. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of PRX and GBH in Boston. Muslims around the world are fasting, praying, and getting together with family for the holy month of Ramadan. In southern Turkey, in the earthquake-devastated region of Hatay, the holiday is carrying a new meaning this year as recovery efforts continue. The World's Duri Buskerin has the story.
A line for food extends down the block of a busy street in downtown Antakya. At dusk, families bring empty yogurt containers or Tupperware to pick up hot food donated by another city. Ali Bozkurt and his wife walked for 2 kilometers to pick up their share. They haven't had anything to eat or drink since about 5 a.m., that's because during Ramadan, observant Muslims fast during daylight hours and eat when the sun goes down. Bozkurt and his family plan to take their meal back to the tent where they're living to break their fast together. It hasn't been going well, he says. We can't go home. We can't prepare food together. We have to take what the state gives us. Today, it's yogurt soup, stewed beef with vegetables, and a rice pilaf, a portion of 15,000 meals prepared each day by municipal workers in a converted shipping container nearby. But all Bozkurt wants is a hot shower. It's been a month since we had a bath, he says. The flies are getting really bad. Few in Antakya are used to standing in food lines. The tidy apartment buildings that survived the earthquake are echoes of a comfortable city near the sea. Some wait with tears in their eyes. I have 10 people who were killed, a woman tells me. My siblings, my in-laws. Look, he's all I have left, she says, pushing a small child in front of her, her grandson. Another line waits outside a long white tent. Mostly relief workers and volunteers, they'll break their fast together when the sun sets. We're trying to live, says 16-year-old Huda Bakunja. We've had a lot of deaths, but we can't die with the dead. Just before dark, people are ushered into the tent and handed styrofoam plates of food. They sit on plastic chairs to wait for the call to prayer that marks the correct time to break the fast. Birol Maric is working with debris removal crews, sleeping in the truck. His family in Kayseri is spending Ramadan together, and it's hard to be away from them. But people here have many more needs, he says. Our families are safe. They have a warm place to sleep. This earthquake could have happened anywhere, and we have to do whatever we can. Finally, the call to prayer signals the end of the day's fast. With a quick prayer, they dig in to eat. For The World, I'm Derya Buskarin, in Antakya, Turkey.
Robotic worms are not, as maybe they sound, something imagined in a creepy horror film, but a tool scientists and engineers have been working to develop for decades to do all sorts of useful things. And recently, they've been making some pretty big breakthroughs. One of the engineers working on this is Yasemin Ozkan Aydın. She teaches electrical engineering at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. Yasemin, so what exactly are robotic worms?
So robotic worms are a type of robots, especially I am talking about the earthworm type robots. They usually have soft body and they mimic the movements of the and function of the biological worms. One of the function of the earthworms, the burrow in under soil and create the tunnels, move under tunnels and so on. And engineers try to create systems similar to earthworms. They have flexible or soft body. The shape is adaptable to surface. And usually the soft ones are made with silicone type soft materials. Other types of robots that has flexible body also has some joints and multiple joints and segments similar to earthworms.
You mentioned that earthworms are specialists at burrowing. What kind of tasks are these robots being developed to do?
So the aim of the earthworm type robots usually to create a system that can burrow under soil. Maybe it can be useful for search and rescue operations, environmental monitoring or medical procedures. So it can have several functions, but the burrowing one is one of the most challenging one that worms do. And you can send this type of, we can create a robot that can burrow under soil, we can send it to the Mars to collect data or So there are several applications.
Is there a reason they're modeled after worms specifically as opposed to, I don't know, moles or something else that lives underground?
Yeah, so worms are special because their bodies are completely soft and they are very adaptable to environment. So if we create something like that, the robotic systems, without any the obstacles around, maybe it can be easy to navigate because the body is adapted to environment and easily move through the tunnels or soil. So there are a lot of factors that you need to think about, but soft body, you can create a robot that has soft body and also the sensors is embedded to the body of the robot, which you can collect the data easily from soil.
How far along are scientists and engineers in the development of these robots? Are there already any out in the world doing their thing?
Yeah, there are some groups in academia and also in industry. Maybe you know the GE has a robot, as a big earthworm type robot that they are trying to burrow under soil. The one factor is that we are still not close to the earthworms, real earthworms, because there are several limits. One of the limits is the power source we use. Most of the earthworm type robots that has the soft body usually actuated by air, so pneumatic actuators. So they are usually the very big. The robot can be small, but the actuation system on the back is the huge actuation system, which cannot be useful for real world application.
You've worked on four different designs for earthworms in your research. How soon do you hope to take, you know, one of them from design to actual robot?
So the first one I built has just a simple robot. It's with the three segments, two segments for anchoring, one segment for elongation of the body, which mimics the peristaltic motion of the earthworms. And the second version, we add the skin, the kerygami skin, to the outside of the body, which helped the robot to anchor its body into the soil. And the third version was we tried to mimic the undulation of the robot's earthworms, and we added multi-segments, and which helped the robot to navigate through the obstacles. And the fourth version, we add sensors, but still we are not close to the earthworm, real earthworms, because still we are trying to locomote on surface, of not under soil.
Lots of iterating there. Yasemin Askan Aydin is an assistant professor of electrical engineering at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
For two decades, Iraq has been on the road to democracy. Recent years have been traumatic, though. In 2019, Iraq witnessed a wave of protests called the Tishreen movement that lasted for more than 2 years. People were on the street for months calling for an end to unemployment and state corruption, among other things. Iraqi security forces responded violently. The World's Shirin Jafari brings us the story of one of those protesters who paid a heavy price.
It was February 16th, 2020, and Mohannad Saad Mohammed was at a demonstration in Baghdad. A group of masked men had gathered around some women protesters, trying to take them away. Mohammed pleaded with the men, saying they could take him instead of the women. These protests are a bright chapter in this country's dark history, he told the masked men. Then, suddenly, one of them charged at Mohammed, and everything went dark. Mohammed says he couldn't breathe. His friends and his cousin rushed him to the hospital in a tuk-tuk, one of those motorized rickshaws that people here use to get around. But there was nothing the doctors could do. The 38-year-old lost one eye, and the other one was severely damaged. Mohammed is just one of hundreds of protesters who ended up with severe eye injuries after the crackdown. According to the UN, nearly 500 protesters were killed and thousands more were injured in just the first few weeks of Iraq's uprising. Amnesty International reported that anti-riot police fired tear gas canisters at protesters, even targeting their heads, in some cases at point-blank range. Mohammed says he's not sure who his attackers were. Maybe Iraqi security forces, maybe members of one of Iraq's powerful militias. He shows me a video his cousin took as they were taking him to the hospital. Mohammed is bleeding and obviously in a lot of pain. As he recalls that day, Mohammed pauses, takes a deep breath, and then lights up a cigarette. He picks up the story by explaining what happened at the hospital. He says security forces showed up there looking for him. He says hospital staff formed a human shield around him, and they stopped the armed men from detaining Mohammed and other injured protesters. Then, in the middle of the night, the staff helped smuggle him out of the hospital in a trash can.
So these are the x-rays, huh?
Doctors told Mohammed he's lucky to be alive. X-rays show dozens of pellets lodged in his head and upper body. Some of them could not be removed. What we have in this country, he tells me, is a fake democracy. A real democracy is where people can speak their minds freely, where elections are fair and people don't get killed just for protesting. In the previous regime, Mohammed says, Shias were marginalized, but Saddam Hussein has been gone for a long time. Even though Shias have power in the government now, we're still suffering.
قسماً بالله العظيم.
No longer able to work, Muhammad had to give up his home in the city. He now lives on the outskirts of Baghdad with his wife and four children. They survive on donations, he says. The Tishreen protests forced Iraq's Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi to resign, but the country still struggles with political infighting and corruption. My friends are all poor, like me, Muhammad says. We all went out to protest because most of us were jobless. We were seeking a better nation. Losing his eyesight hasn't stopped Muhammad from going to the streets. In fact, just recently, he was out protesting again. I know that I could be either killed or imprisoned, he says. But I breathe for Iraq. This is the path that I have chosen. And if I die, it will be the greatest honor of my life. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Baghdad, Iraq.
Japan boasts one of the world's highest criminal conviction rates. More than 90% of cases end in convictions. The country also has the death penalty. Some think this tough legal system has helped make Japan one of the safest countries on earth. In recent years, though, a number of high-profile prisoners have been exonerated. That's shaken the criminal justice system there and given hope to inmates, like a former pro boxer in Japan who's now the world's longest-serving death row inmate. From Tokyo, Tisanka Sirapala has our story.
Iwao Hakamada's professional boxing career was cut short in 1966 when he confessed to robbing and murdering four people. His criminal case and decades-long campaign for freedom were made into a popular feature film in Japan. At 87, he's now frail and suffers from dementia, and despite confessing to the grisly murder, he has maintained his innocence. In Japan, many defendants in criminal cases are convicted solely on a confession. Japan Director of Human Rights Watch, Kanaya Doi, says that's because people who claim innocence face harsher treatment while in custody.
The Japanese legal system does not presume someone innocent and then punishes someone who do not confess, even before the judgment is delivered.
Prosecutors are allowed to interrogate suspects without an attorney for up to 23 days. Doi says many defendants during this time are coerced by police into making a confession.
Shame is, a highlight. That you don't confess means you are lying, and then you're a liar, you're a shameful person. You know, this kind of verbal attack is used almost always.
Less than 3% of interrogations are videotaped, which makes it difficult to prove any police wrongdoing. In recent years, several wrongful convictions have been overturned, putting the criminal justice system into the spotlight. After 5 decades of campaigning in March, the Hakamada support group cheered after finding out that Hakamada had been awarded a retrial. New DNA evidence has raised doubts about his guilt and suggests that evidence was planted during his trial. This allowed for his temporary release 9 years ago. Hakamada's 90-year-old sister Hideko addressed the public after winning a retrial. I'm so happy to hear that we can proceed with a retrial, she says. Iwao has suffered 48 years in prison. I'm so glad we fought for so long. In the press conference, she said the retrial is a momentous occasion that is lost on her brother due to his poor mental state. After decades of solitary confinement, Hakamada now suffers from a psychological disorder known as death row syndrome. We will continue to fight in the retrial, she says. But even if I tell him, I'm not sure how much he will understand. In Japan, there are currently 107 death row inmates, and all of them are kept in solitary confinement. Mai Sato is an expert in the death penalty and director of Monash University's Ilios Justice Center. She says death row inmates are notified about their execution only hours before, and they live in fear that every day could be their last.
They're just notified in the morning, and then they're executed a few hours later, so they can't see their family, they can't reach out to the lawyers.
Government surveys show that 80% of the Japanese people are in favor of capital punishment, but Sato says there's a lack of critical reporting and transparency about execution procedures, and there's little known about the death row inmates' access to healthcare and the conditions they're kept in.
Medical doctors are difficult to recruit, and prison wardens are not medical professionals, right? But the final decision lies with them.
Since the 1960s, Japan has exonerated just 19 victims of wrongful convictions. But some experts believe that number is a lot higher. Sato says prosecutors carry a lot of power in the Japanese legal system.
If you look at Iwao Hakamada's case, it's clear that the cause of wrongful conviction was in police investigation. And then I also blame the prosecutors because they must have known that this case was built on shaky evidence.
When it comes to getting a second chance, Hakamada is one of the lucky ones, but his chance to prove his innocence depends on a timely retrial. For The World, I'm Tsunga Sirapala in Tokyo.
Money makes the world go round. These days, less and less of that is cash. British banknote printer De La Rue says demand for cash has hit their lowest level in 2 decades. That might be a bad thing for companies that manufacture banknotes, but Harvard University economist Kenneth Rogoff thinks the global trend of paying without cash has its upsides. Rogoff is the author of The Curse of Cash. Ken, who profits and who loses around the world as cash is phased out?
Well, governments make money off of cash, especially when interest rates are high like today, because it may not seem like it, but they can print cash instead of borrowing money. They just print cash and buy stuff, whereas if they had to borrow, they'd have to, you know, issue a treasury bill and pay 5%, and so they make a profit off of that. On the other hand, if you actually ask who uses cash, ordinary people certainly use small bills, but most cash is in very large bills. So in the case of the United States, 80% of our cash is in $100 bills. I think we have 50 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And I don't know about you, but I don't have that many. And a lot of it's used for tax evasion, illegal activity.
Where in the world has demand for cash dropped off the most?
Well, there are some countries which are, you know, really enthusiastic about paying on their phone or with other digital payments mechanism. So Sweden's an example where the demand for cash, you know, really has plummeted. But there's still a lot of bills floating out there from things we don't see, particularly this tax evasion and illegal activity.
So you argue that the regulation of paper bills and more recently digital currencies is to blame for some of the world's biggest problems, but you also say it might help solve these big, thorny global problems. In a nutshell, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's very unfair that some businesses, because they're cash businesses, pay no taxes. The owners don't think so, and it means much higher taxes for other people. It's a big deal. So, for example, in countries like Italy, maybe a quarter of all taxes aren't paid. And even in Germany and France, it might be 15%. In the United States, it's smaller because income tax is easy to collect, but it's still probably 15% of personal taxes are never paid. And a lot of that has to do with cash. So that's sort of what the problem is. And then there's human trafficking, all kinds of money laundering, drugs, etc. On the upside, having more digital currencies would really have a lot of advantages. For example, when we wanted to do the stimulus payments, it was easy for people that had bank accounts, but we have a lot of people who are unbanked who the government couldn't do it that way.
Ken, I know part of the issue with the move away from cash is that folks who don't have bank accounts or credit cards then, you know, can't pay for things that they need. How do you get around that issue if you're advocating for, you know, the lessening of the number of banknotes in the system?
So it's a little bit like with healthcare, where the U.S. is in this curious position for a rich country of not really providing free healthcare to everyone. The same thing's true with banking services. Even India provides free accounts to everybody. They don't necessarily fill the accounts with cash, but in most countries of the world, they provide very, very subsidized free basic bank accounts, debit accounts to lower income people. It would cost almost nothing to do. It's absolutely stunning that we don't do that.
Kenneth Rogoff teaches economics at Harvard University. He's also the author of The Curse of Cash. Thanks so much. This is really interesting.
Thank you for having me.
I want you to take a minute now and picture women's fashion from the 1960s. Miniskirts, tights and boots, hair in a bob, lots of mascara. So much of that signature 60s look came from Mary Quant. She's a British designer who brought miniskirts to the masses. She died today at age 93. The world's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
Mary Quant completely transformed the way women were dressing. She once told the CBC her philosophy was not to be boring.
I think the point of clothes should be, one, that you're noticed, two, that you look sexy, and three, that you feel good.
Quant was born in the 1930s in London. Her first job out of art school was working for a high-end hat maker in Mayfair, a posh neighborhood of London. It was not for her. As she said, I didn't want to look like a duchess. You know you make me want to shine. In 1955, Quant and her husband opened a boutique in Chelsea, where the music was loud and the drinks flowed. Definitely a new kind of shopping experience for the new generation. Quant designed for young women with access to jobs, a paycheck, and the pill, says fashion historian Kimberly Chrisman Campbell.
There was this huge youth population that suddenly had money to spend and didn't know what to wear, because up until this time, young women had pretty much dressed like their mothers, and they wanted to have their own style.
Quant gave them clothes to run and dance in. Miniskirts, loose-shift dresses, hot pants, flat shoes, and tights, which up to that point were only for dancers, but now you needed them to keep warm in your miniskirt. The look was sexy and fun, and a surefire way to annoy your mom, says fashion curator Shona Marshall.
You know, I think it really was about sort of not being square and rejecting this kind of idea that you were going to be like your parents, you were going to sort of settle down, get married, be conventional.
Quant's clothes became wildly popular. They were worn by Twiggy and Patty Boyd, who was married to George Harrison of the Beatles at the time. And speaking of the Beatles, some compared Quant's impact on fashion with the Fab Four's impact on music.
Mary Quant was incendiary, anarchic, really capturing this kind of youthquake movement and the music of the time and the kind of swinging London.
One moment that really sums up Mary Quant is this 1966 interview.
But Mary, isn't the miniskirt rather obvious, simply blaringly enticing? After all, it seems that few girls really have the legs, hips, and above all, the panache to carry it off majestically.
She gives the reporter a withering, dismissive look and says,
but who wants to be majestic?
Quant rejected the idea that women should be majestic, put on a pedestal and made to act refined. Mary Quant, the designer who helped to define 60s fashion and once said, good taste is death, vulgarity is life, has died. She was 93. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
That is where we wrap things up today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.